Hello, this is Michael Stone, the host of Conversations. We're committed to bringing you leading-edge thinkers in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. On our program, we look for positive solutions to local and global issues that leave you touched, moved, and inspired to action. Our weekly guests include local and global experts and concerned citizens working together to heal the wounds that separate, alienate, and marginalize people. This is Michael Stone. You're listening to Conversations. I have a wonderful show planned for you today. My guest is Linda Lantieri, and she is a Fulbright Scholar, keynote speaker, and internationally known expert in social and emotional learning and conflict resolution. Linda Lantieri serves as the director of the Inner Resilience Program, co-founder of the Resolving Conflict Creatively Program, and is one of the founding board members of the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning. She has over 40 years' experience in education as a teacher, director of middle school in East Harlem, faculty member at Hunter College in New York City. Linda has shown a lifetime of commitment to enriching the daily lives of adults and children alike. She's a co-author of Waging Peace in Our Schools, the editor of Schools with Spirit, Nurturing the Inner Lives of Children and Teachers, and the author of Building Emotional Intelligence, Techniques to Cultivate Inner Strength in Children. Welcome to Conversations, Linda.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Michael.
So let's start out by just defining the term that, of course, was coined by Daniel Goleman. That's the emotional intelligence. What are we talking about when we're talking about emotional intelligence?
Well, what we're talking about really is a capacity to, first of all, recognize your own feelings, those of others, for motivating yourself and for managing your emotions well in others and in relationships. So it's a set of sort of skills that can be developed, by the way, that are both inner type skills like self-awareness and self-management and outer skills like social awareness and the relationship kinds of skills and responsible decision making. So it's a variety of competencies that make up emotional intelligence.
I think you spent a lot of time in the education system working with conflict resolution issues.
Yes, that's true. And first of all, I just want to say that you've had so many wonderful people on your show that have been great teachers of mine. And it was a real pleasure listening to some of those programs.
You.
And so glad you have them online. Yes, I began when I was very young in East Harlem. I was 20 years old when I was faced with teaching 37 children in front of me. And it was a time in our country, little later on, when we were actually losing a classroom full of children to violence on the streets of our cities every 98 minutes.
Wow.
And I began to think about that early on in terms of what schools could do to turn some of that tide around. And clearly we're seeing the same kinds of things even today. But I think that we're talking more now not only about turning away from the outward violence we see, but cultivating the values and the dispositions that are grounded in such mutual respect and compassion for each other that we wouldn't resort to that at all.
I'd have to say, if I was starting school out today, I'd be scared as hell.
Mm-hmm.
Just the stories alone, kids setting other kids on fire, the brutality, the drugs, the lack of respect, and the lack of grounding with children. Let's talk about some of the challenges of the 21st century that you see and how your programs might be addressing them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as you just shared, many young people are facing a world of a great deal of uncertainty, and their coping skills are low, and they're low in resilience. You know, what I talk a lot about in my latest book, that ability to successfully manage your life as well as adapt to stressful events and change and be able to bounce back with life experiences. The ones that are advantageous to us, by the way, as well as the ones that are really challenging or traumatic. And I came to the more recent work, as you probably know, through being very involved in being in New York City on September 11th, 2001, and being very near what happened to children that day.
Say a little bit about that.
Well, you know, most people don't actually know that within hours of the morning of September 11th, 2001, we could not have predicted that what was happening and what we were seeing unfold on television was actually affecting the lives of 5,000 New York City children with their 200 teachers and other school staff who would actually be running for their lives in about an hour.
I didn't know anything about that until I read your book.
Yeah. So that was really, really incredible. And it was the sixth day of school. The adults in charge had to basically make the ultimate decision of their lives and their careers because they realized that saving the children would mean evacuating the schools and actually running to safety. And I would have to say that in that moment, those in charge had to access that inner wisdom or that inner well of what I call inner resilience. And how well those courageous children and their teachers did on that day clearly had very little to do with how well they did on standardized tests, you know, later in the year.
Right.
It was quite a situation of uncertainty, and I remember one teacher expressing to me later that in that instance, she said she felt like she understood what it meant to be a teacher because she could run no faster than the little kindergarten girl's hand who she was holding could run.
Yeah.
So having been in Manhattan that day and coming to be asked to support the teachers and schools in Ground Zero, I really had some very profound realizations that what we really needed to do to equip children to have the inner strength they'll really need to meet these intense challenges. Of course, that was a really strong example of an intense challenge, but there are intense challenges that will come their way as well as great opportunities. And how could we as the adults in kids' lives actually cultivate these ways of being that happened that day for the students and the teachers in Ground Zero? Who did remain calm and balanced, by the way, in the midst of all of this. But what would it take to refill that well if something happened 3 days from that date? And, of course, it took them a very long time to heal, and that healing process is still happening.
Yes, it is. Why is social and emotional competence so important in this time?
Well, I think, first, because of what we said a little previously, which is that our kids today are just having such low coping skills and low resilience to sort of face the challenges that they face and to be able to bounce back with those challenges as well as to be there for the wonderful opportunities. And what social and emotional learning does is provide them with a strong framework and foundation to really optimally develop all of who they can be, both as children who care and are responsive to others as well as to themselves. And we even find out from the research that they're better in academic performance. They have improved school attitudes and behavior. There's less negative behavior that they begin to exhibit. And they have just reduced emotional distress when they learn these skills of emotional intelligence, which we call social and emotional learning in the school context.
We talked a little bit about what the children are up against coming to school.
Yes.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what they're up against at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was growing up, there was at least a parent at home generally, and things were moving much slower pace. It was a kinder, gentler kind of time in the home. Tell us a little bit about how you integrate your teaching with the parents of the children.
Well, the most recent book, Building Emotional Intelligence, really challenges both teachers and parents to make the time with their child to have this kind of quiet reflection time where they're able to really, really help their children develop these skills in a very conscious kind of way. the book sort of outlines some of the things that you can do with children in this quiet time. But what is also wonderful is that Daniel Goldman, who is a dear friend and also is the person that really brought to mind and to bear the skills and research in emotional intelligence in his book, Emotional Intelligence, has done the CD that can be used with children of different age levels. So it's sort of a tool to get parents to really know what they already do know, which is spending that quiet reflection time with your child is something that a child really needs and wants and is hoping would happen. And this is just an intentional way that that could take place, really.
I just have to speak to the parents here for just a second, because this book that Linda Lantieri has written, Techniques to Cultivate Inner Strength in Children, Building Emotional Intelligence, it is an amazing book, and even more amazing, it comes with a CD in the back that was done by Daniel Goldman, and who you just said wrote Emotional Intelligence. And I listened to the whole CD. I was fascinated because I wanted to hear how you were able to do the things that I struggle with as an adult in terms of meditation techniques and awareness and these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And it's just a brilliant CD. I found it playful and engaging, and I just love doing it. So tell a little bit about the story about creating this and the response to this CD that you've done.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Michael, because Daniel and I were very, very careful about putting it through a developmental lens, which a lot of this wonderful, wonderful contemplative practice work has not been put through yet in terms of children and what it is would be helpful for children to learn about mindfulness, about relaxing their bodies. So we did a lot of work with that, and we also worked with developmental psychologists because we really wouldn't want children to sort of go to a place in their inner world that isn't a place that would be comfortable and would also they would be able to do, so to speak. So it took us a while to get that and to see how long these should be, how we should use language, what kinds of pauses we should have. So there was a lot of thinking about all of that. And I've had only wonderful responses to it, both from parents and teachers alike. And there's something about the CD, because when you sort of put this CD on, first of all, there's the repetition, which we know strengthens the neural pathways to that place of relaxation each time it happens in that repetitive way. But the second thing is that kids kind of get ready for it, and they know it's a CD that is not going to stop necessarily. Of course, it could. The adult could stop it. But somehow there's a calm that comes over the kids regardless because it's a CD, which is very interesting to me.
And they'll know it. I could just see my daughter when she was 6 or 7 and just starting school saying, "Daddy, can I listen to that relaxation CD again?"
Exactly.
It really calls.
Well, one of the parents told me this story, and I might have put it in the book, but I'm not sure because I think she was in the pilot. We piloted it, by the way, with several parents of different cultural and ethnic backgrounds, and they gave us wonderful feedback to sort of be reflective and culturally responsive as well to this. So one of the parents talked about her 5-year-old boy, Eli, who she said would pretty much have a regular routine around sleep time. She would read to him, he would say he was ready to go to sleep, and she would leave the room, and about 30 minutes later, every single night, he would come out and say, "Mom, I can't sleep." And she did the CD a couple of different times, and sure enough, one night, the 30 minutes passed, 40 minutes passed, and she was dumbfounded because this was a pretty much pattern response on Eli's part. And she walks into the room, and what does she hear but Dan's voice? He has put the CD on, and she has no idea he's in the room. And she waits till it's the end, and he looks up quite surprised. He said, "Oh, I'm relaxed now. I don't need you. I can go to sleep." That, unbelievable.
That is wonderful.
I mean, that is after two times that that parent actually used the CD, that he got up and realized that he could self-manage in such a way. You know, of course, I like to tell parents that you don't want to use it necessarily as a sleep tool every night, you know, that that is not a good idea. But occasionally, it's a great idea, you know.
You know, Linda, at this age, let's talk about brain development a little bit in young people. Our entire physiognomy is changing and evolving here, especially with the changes in the frontal lobe. We just did a show on rewiring your brain and on the plasticity of it and things like that recently. And I'd like to see how you've included that, because I know you talk about brain development. Can you tell us a little bit about...
So. Well, I think you said it well, that the area of the brain most shaped by experience during childhood is actually the prefrontal cortex, the brain's executive center. And this idea of neuroplasticity is relatively new, that our experiences that we have during childhood and throughout our whole life actually shape our brain. And the experiences during childhood in the prefrontal cortex shape our brain in a variety of ways, because this is the area that holds the circuits both for inhibiting disruptive kind of emotional impulses, but also for paying attention. That's what's really key about why it's important to teach children to quiet the mind and calm the body, because they're in the same place in the brain's executive center, this place of paying attention and inhibiting disruptive emotional impulses. So when children don't have strategies that would decrease their anxiety, then there's actually less attention available to them, really, to learn or solve a problem or grasp a new idea. And a child, for example, who gets panicked, you know, if there's a pop quiz in front of him or her, or not even a pop quiz, the day of the standardized test in most schools across this country is the dreaded day for teachers. They'll actually imprint that response of anxiety rather than the details of the material they need to access. So as Dan says in the intro to the book, it's a very strong statement, but he says, distress kills learning, you know.
Yes.
But we now believe that improving attention and memory, along with freeing the mind from impulsivity, is possible. And it also puts the child in the best zone for learning. Social emotional learning does that.
Yeah,
that's what we're talking about.
You have you and Daniel and a number of other people created an organization called CASEL, Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning.
Yes.
And my sense is that that's much bigger than just those words there. It's something that you've created to really transform the educational system. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing there?
Sure. Well, and we're CASEL is about to take a really big leap as well. We have a big summit next week in Washington with 100 leading thinkers who will be convened to really shape the future of social and emotional learning in education. And CASEL was established in a very grassroots way. Dan Goldman, myself, Eileen Rockefeller Growald, and a couple of other people began to convene experts in diverse fields like child development, education, psychology, to really share their work and bring the science and practice of this to bear. But today, CASEL is an independent nonprofit organization. We work with diverse collaborators, and we're really seeking to move forward the agenda of actually actualizing that social and emotional learning would be a basic of education in this country, because we feel we're ready to do that. And we have both the research and the practice behind us in what we know to be able to expand to millions of children, really.
Some of the statistics that you were talking about in your book were pretty shocking. The 70 to 90% of all doctor visits are stress-related, and that there's 5 billion tranquilizers a year used.
Yeah.
One of them that really struck me was 1 out of 5 children in the 9 to 17-year-old have a diagnosed mental disorder.
Yeah.
And I'd like to get into a little bit about how your program actually works, so people get a sense of what they can do to help with building and developing inner strength and emotional learning. I think the first thing is to get your book and the CD, but let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts, because this has been many years of research.
Yeah, I would say the nuts and bolts are really becoming savvy about this field of social emotional learning, and that schools need to go in this direction, because there's growing evidence that the learning that we used to talk about as academic and the learning that was social and emotional aspects are really one. We can't make that distinction anymore because they're so interconnected. And there's growing evidence that tells us that these two kinds of learning are very linked and that our emotions and our relationships affect how and what we learn. So if we're parents, we're dedicated citizens, we're part of a community, I think one of the things we could all begin to do is not only bring it into our homes, that is, through something like this book or reading other books that give us some idea of how to be your child's emotional coach, and John Gottman has done a lot of good work in this area as well, but to really advocate for this kind of vision of education that includes this school-based development of children's social and emotional as something that is a given, as math and reading is a given.
Yes.
And we really sell people a myth when we convince them that if a child does well academically, they're going to have success in life and work. And I think that we know enough now to know that that is not an equation that's accurate.
That it's actually damaging.
Yeah, young people need a lot more skills, and many of them are getting to the workplace, yeah. And they're getting to the place of having deeper relationships and starting families and saying, you didn't teach me all I need to know here, adults, in my life.
Well, we certainly have a need for the transformation of our educational system. I mean, when you think about where we've come with the IQ, and the highest thing is to have a high IQ or be a Mensa or a valedictorian, and it's all about learning. But what is it learning? We're learning things basically to make us better consumers in a lot of ways.
Exactly.
And that is a real shame that that's happening. So I always tell people, no matter what the subject is we talk about, and they're always about education or climate change or spiritual fulfillment or social justice, the first thing is get informed, and the second thing is get active.
Yes,
and
exactly.
It's the same thing in this, isn't it? Isn't that what we need to do?
Yes, it is the same thing. And it's really first expanding our vision ourselves of what it means to be an educated person, because most people would feel that if a school that your child went to was delivering wonderful grades on standardized achievement tests, which it seems that schools are judged on, you would feel a great education is happening in that school. And I think we have to dispel that myth inside ourselves and say, but is social and emotional learning happening? Are young people, as a regular part of their lives, getting social and emotional competence in the areas we talked about before, and self-awareness and self-management and relationship skills and responsible decision-making? We even tell kids, calm down, but we don't teach them how.
Well, let's talk about another part of this whole equation here, which is what I think many people probably know, but those academic scores that you're talking about, those achievement tests, are directly related to the area of funding for the school and, of course, paying for people's salaries and other things. I'd like to hear you talk about that. And also, you're a teacher, so I'm going to go into a touchy area here. I'd like you to talk about the relationship of this to tenure.
Well, that's a tough one.
That's a touchy one, I know.
Let me just say that the good news is that when you talk about bringing the framework and the skills of social and emotional learning into the school, doesn't have to be an either-or situation. That's the good news. Why? Because we know that students who participate in SEL programs actually increase achievement scores on the average of 11 percentile points.
Wow, good
versus
point.
Versus students who do not participate. So that's the good news. The even better news is that we find out that the way they improve might be equal to some of the other ways we are trying to improve schools or trying to improve academics, say by bringing in a better reading program or decreasing class size. SEL, without a question, stands out as something that improves kids' achievement scores their ability as measured on the achievement test equally, if not more. So that's the good news.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say the bad news is that we have such a narrow vision of what it is kids need to be fully prepared to face life's opportunities and challenges. And I think that's the news that then gets us to what do we really know by standardized test scores and nothing else. You know, we often talk about at Castle that there needs to be another side of the report card, the side that we're talking about now. And it's really that combination of both that will make for a well-rounded, healthy child who would be ready to lead us into the 21st century.
When you talk about cultivating and enhancing emotional intelligence, you talk about five basic skills: self-awareness, social awareness, self-management, responsible decision-making, and relationship skills.
Mm-hmm.
Can you take each of those and kind of give us an example of how the program works with that?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say that there are many good research-based programs. So, for example, I'm the co-founder of Resolving Conflict Creatively program, but Castle has done a wonderful kind of consumer guide where they've looked at lots of providers and given a sense of their efficacy, basically. So rather than saying my program, I would say how it's done in social and emotional learning. So, for example, with self-awareness, where you're beginning to accurately assess your emotions, one thing that comes to mind is a first-grade teacher in New Orleans who used to have little milk cartons with different emotions on it, happy, sad, lonely, and other. And when kids would come in every morning, they would take a popsicle stick that had their name on it, and they would put it into the one that fit for them that day.
Oh, I love that.
But what was equally interesting, and then she just simply started her day by shaking each box and saying, there are some people here are happy, there are some people that are feeling sad right now, and does anybody want to say anything about that? And sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't. But what was so astounding is that often if you stayed in her class long enough, and this comes right from our curriculum, this strategy, you would see kids get up in the middle of something and begin to realize, this is self-awareness, that their mood was changing, and they would find their stick and put it somewhere else.
Wow.
Yeah. So, again, that's self-awareness, basically. Now, self-management, where you're having to be aware of your emotions but not let them control you, has a lot to do with the Building Emotional Intelligence book, where we're teaching some concrete skills that kids have as well as maintain inside of them of that calm place that they could go to. In other words, that they are in charge of their own physiology. And I think that we could teach the self-management work not only in teaching kids things like being able to listen well and being able to say what you need and want without putting somebody else down, but self-management can also be that they are familiar with that place inside them that calms them. And so when you're practicing that quiet time at home, you're continuing to strengthen those neural pathways that practice that area of the brain that is your self-management area. I mean, I've seen kids, for example, during a standardized test, put down the pencil, take some deep breaths, and then pick it up again, because they know they have a better opportunity of accessing all that's in their mind if they're at a relaxed alertness place rather than an anxiety-ridden place.
A lot of adults could certainly use that also.
Exactly. So yeah. Then when there's self-management, when you're able to actually manage your own emotions and the level of them and the intensity of them, then you're able to actually show empathy to others. Often kids who are not able to manage their own emotions have a harder time showing empathy, because what they basically want to do, and this is true for adults too, is they want to get out of their own emotional distress so they take care of themselves. So you have to sort of be able to manage your emotions to be able to really be there for others, and then to be able to pick up and understand others, and appreciating the similarities and the differences. So for social awareness, we give kids lots of opportunities for that to happen in the classroom, of showing empathy and caring through cooperative learning, through a variety of activities that require cooperation and empathy, as well as activities that could be done at home. And that, of course, begins to establish that those positive relationships that are based on cooperation, and also teaching kids some concrete conflict resolution skills of how to be able to say what they need and want without putting someone else down, to be able to be assertive without being aggressive. And then finally, just teaching them some clear decision-making techniques that help them put a problem through some stages of first calming down and then seeing what their alternatives are and beginning to think through one that's best for them. Good news is that our emotional intelligence can improve throughout our life. But clearly, in K through 12 education is the biggest window of opportunity. There's no question about it.
When I'm not doing radio, I'm teaching moving meditation classes. Ah. And one of the hardest things for people who come, and we have people from youngsters to people in their 90s that come, but one of the across-the-board hardest things is cultivating stillness.
Yes.
There's something about your program and listening to the CD that really seems to me to be geared in that way. Before you talk about that, I'm going to invite any parents who would like to call in and ask Linda. I usually don't have call-ins. This is such an important subject that I'd like to get you involved. So if any of you out there who are parents or who are interested in transforming the education system would like to call in, I will be glad to pick up some calls today. But let's talk about this cultivating stillness first.
Well, I think you're right, Michael, that we live in a culture that sort of doesn't almost honor this going within and this stillness. And Parker Palmer, one of my teachers, would say that you welcome soul to show up. So I think that it takes young people a while, but then they crave it. So the good news is that most teachers and parents sort of tell me that the children themselves remind the adults that they want this time once it becomes regular. And that's really exciting to me.
Yes.
Because then you're giving them something that they'll have for the rest of their lives, the quality of stillness and quietness that I think we all so deeply need. It's those moments of stillness and quietness that we could have our best kind of reflection, our deepest wisdom, our creativity comes out, all kinds of things happen that we often are too busy to think in that way, basically. So I would agree that I think that they're both in the classroom and I've seen in homes that somehow this work does honor that silence in such a way that children really crave it. And I've heard many stories of that, of almost missing quiet time and reminding the teacher or the parent that they needed it. So that's the wonderful part of it, that young people really take to it once they're experiencing it.
Yes, I can really see that. Linda, what's your website?
We have a couple of websites. I would point you first to www.castle.org. And my own website, www.lindalantieri.org, L-A-N-T-I-E-R-I. And that'll get you to other websites that are helpful as well.
Great. Thank you so much. Let's talk about the role of parents and what parents can do to help not only cultivate this in their children, but to help transform the education system.
Yes.
You've been involved all your life, pretty much. Tell us some of the thoughts that and things that really work that parents can leverage to help transform our education system.
Well, I think, first of all, I would say to the parents listening that you are really your children's first teacher. And teachers that come after that need to recognize that, acknowledge that, and support you in that, because that's the truth. And so the first thing is that that relationship of other teachers with you as a parent needs to be one that schools honor and respect and nurture. So what you would want to expect of your school is that there's that open door system of relationship between you and those that are teaching your child. So that's first of all. But secondly, certainly over the years, as I've brought social and emotional learning programs into school districts across the country, from small school districts in rural Oregon to Phoenix and Boston and Newark, New Jersey, parents had a lot to do with deciding that we wouldn't cut the program or we would move forward in that way. In fact, in many of those situations, either in the first reason I actually came to the district or needing to have parents' support as it progressed and we needed more and more in crazy times around money to keep putting that on the front burner, parents and community have been extremely instrumental. And for us with as CASEL to make the changes we're talking about at the national level, we are going to need a whole movement of citizens beginning to ask for another vision of education.
Let's take some of these calls that are coming in. Hold on just a second. Hello, caller. You're live on Conversations with Linda Lantieri.
Good afternoon, Michael. I have a couple of questions for Linda. Linda, I'm wondering if you could share your experience and or knowing about one being connected to or primarily in either their emotional intelligence or intellectual intelligence. Do you see that happening independently or simultaneously, predominantly?
Yeah, it's a good question. I will say what I say, but I feel like it might be a brain person's question. It certainly is integrated. It's for me, they're both exactly what I said earlier on, that the growing evidence suggests that the two kinds of learning, what we would call academic or intellectual and social and emotional aspects, are really not so apart, that they're intricately linked. And they're intricately linked because of how much our emotions and our relationships and our levels of stress and anxiety affect how we learn and what we learn. So in that sense, they are very, very linked, as we talked a little bit about earlier in the program. What were you thinking when you asked the question? What are some of your thoughts?
Well, my experience for myself and my observation of others is that in those times or moments when one is in the grips of their emotional being,
yes,
that all the intelligence goes out the back door.
Right.
I'm curious, the question that I'm really moving towards is,
yes,
are there techniques to toggle or to switch from when one is caught in their emotional intelligence,
yep,
if in a fear-based place,
yep,
and I'm unable to access my intelligence, my intellectual intelligence that tells me, no, this is the clear decision, and even though that's so, I have a hard time escaping the emotional.
Right. Well, what you're describing, Dan talks about in his first book, Emotional Intelligence. He talks about emotional hijacking. That if, for example, there are present these disruptive emotional impulses, then your ability to pay attention and to really be able to act accordingly doesn't happen. You know, he talks about this dirty back alley, that if you see something in the present that is reminding you or triggering you of something in the past that kind of hasn't been worked through, then what happens is that you're immediately responding versus going to the center of your brain that says, oh, don't do this, you know, this is somebody's ear, you know, Mike Tyson, you know, don't do this, this is your boss, you know, it hijacks all of that. So what happens when we develop social and emotional learning is that we strengthen that connection between those two things, and we also help somebody be able to access changing their physiology in a moment's time, which is very powerful. Because once you become balanced and the fight and flight response is not triggering, then you can access both parts in a clearer way.
You're saying that an integration and developing a stronger integration of the two rather than trying to redirect oneself out of the emotional center into the intellectual.
Yeah, I think eventually it's a stronger integration of the two that you really need to make good decisions and all of those things. But when you're experiencing a potential, you have to get emotional hijacking. You have to do something just before you're actually emotionally hijacked. So you've got to teach people about their triggers and what are some things you do just before you get emotionally hijacked. And when you see yourself doing those things, yes, then I think redirecting attention is very helpful if you have ways, which is part of the developing regulation, if you have ways to come to do that.
I see. Very much appreciate your perspective, and I so enjoy this term hijacking. It makes
Thank
it very clear. It's very appropriate.
Thank you.
Great questions, Colin. Thanks so much. Thanks. Looking at all the differences of the children and how our education system is so rote and so you follow the lesson plan, and yet one person might excel in music and another person might excel in something else, and we don't cultivate their, I'm going to use the term, natural genius.
Yep. Absolutely.
And so can you comment about the things that you're trying to do with Castle and to change that and to actually honor the whole student?
Yes. Well, I think that putting social and emotional learning on the front burner is a big start in being able to create the conditions in a school and in a classroom to actually see and teach the whole child, because we're beginning to give young people the kinds of skills that help them move in all kinds of directions, not only their intellectual capacities. But we're also, in helping teachers bring in the social and emotional domain, we're helping teachers understand that there are all different kinds of intelligences, that the interpersonal and intrapersonal, as Howard Gardner would call them, are there in social emotional learning, but so are the musical and the kinesthetic and the movement and mathematical intelligences, and that we need to be thinking about all of those ways in which we are intelligent, and that we can have a situation in a classroom that honors all of those ways.
That's a good place to wrap it up, because that's really what the vision is, so beautiful to have that, where every child, you know, we had Raffi on recently, and I just love Raffi, and I always have, and the concept of child honoring, and, you know, I just want to thank you, Linda, and acknowledge you for being one of the leaders and pioneers in the idea of child honoring, and really the respect that you bring, as well as the emotional learning and the working with the inner strength. I just am so blessed, and our listeners are too, to have you join us here today.
Well, it was a pleasure to be with you, Michael.
Thank you. Take care. I will talk to you very soon.
Bye-bye.
Conversations is an independently produced program supported by KVMR 89.5 Nevada City and listener contributions. We are committed to bringing you leading-edge thinking in the areas of environmental restoration, social justice, and spiritual fulfillment. If you would like to receive our complimentary newsletter, The Well of Light, make a contribution, or order any of our past shows, please call 530-477-7757 or go to our website at rwelistening.net.